Author M. Joanne Nesbitt discusses her book, Legendary Locals of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Thank you for being here. Thank you, gentlemen in the back, for being here, all of you. I just want you to know that in this age of transparency, that I am not a native of Ann Arbor. I am not a native of Michigan. I am even not a native of Indiana, but I am a Hoosier who crawled across the border to come here to Ann Arbor for work. I will also have to tell you that the name on the book says M. Joanne. Joanne is not my first name. Margaret is my first name. There were too many of Margaret's in the family. So my family decided to call me Joe. Friends call me Joanne, but the federal government, the state government, and bill collectors know me as Margaret. So that's how that works. And later I will explain my attire. So the postcard that we see up here is from the Bentley Historical Library collection of postcards and their image bank. And just to let you know that you can get to that through a computer, and there are about 403 wonderful pictures of old-time Michigan and some of them more modern Michigan in their image bank, and those can be downloaded right off their site free. So if you're interested in more, you can just get right to that. I do not know the date of this postcard, but you can see some of the Ann Arbor architectural symbols in there, including the tower. And let's see, anyone else recognize anything else? St. Thomas Church. Someone, yes. Okay, so that's where that came from. So welcome to Ann Arbor, just as it says. Now, Ann Arbor seemed welcoming to a woman by the name of Sophia. In Ann Arbor's early days, she came here from New York. She married a man named Pierce. They had five children. Sophia Pierce was a writer in the Elmira, New York area, and she submitted her articles and stories to many national magazines. So she kept that up when she came to Ann Arbor, and she contributed to the Ann Arbor Courier, a regular column. However, that wasn't enough. You know, that with five kids, that just wasn't enough. So she became what we believe to be the first and only at that time female census enumerator in Michigan. And she also was a clairvoyant physician. A clairvoyant physician, and she practiced this in the Elmira area of New York, and she practiced here. She does not have to touch you nor ask you any questions in order to diagnose what your problem is. So there. So I think it's interesting that she was able to do that, because now we have doctors who can diagnose via internet. You don't meet them in person. I'm sure they do ask you questions, however, and you participate. But there's a little shady area in there between clairvoyant and the internet. Our book is put together in chapters running from the early times. Oh, I forgot to tell you the most important part about this. We need to go backwards. This bridge. So while she was Sophia Pierce was a definite reporter. She reported in her stories to the Ann Arbor Courier that there was a baptism in the Huron River. And not particularly on this bridge, but on a like bridge, a wooden bridge, many people turned out to witness the baptism. So many people turned out that the bridge collapsed, and a lot more people were baptized than they had originally figured on. So now we're moving on. This is in Hanover Park. Do you know where Hanover Park was? It was the first park in Ann Arbor, dedicated in 1836 at the corner of what is now Packard and Division. It was a rather large park at its time because it was called Hanover Square Park. And there's nothing square right there. Parts of the park were lopped off to widen Packard and for other projects in that particular area. But was anyone living here in Ann Arbor before 1982? Oh, look at all you people, good. This piece of sculpture stood in a traffic island at the corner of State and Liberty. Does anyone remember that? And in 1982, it was moved to Hanover Park. The title of the piece is Tree of Knowledge. Can you tell what it is? Do you know what it is? Those are tumbling pages from books. Yes. So it is now right across the street from the graduate student housing unit. So you still fits into the university town. This is the Mozart. Did you know that Mozart was here in Ann Arbor? You did? Well, this was Donald Mozart, who had a very questionable childhood. Supposedly he was captured, kidnapped, put on a ship, didn't know who his parents were, never found his parents, and eventually ended up in Ann Arbor. Kind of sounds like some other people we may know. But in 1867, he opened a jewelry store in Ann Arbor, and he also started manufacturing watches. His watches that he manufactured could tell the quarter second, the seconds, the minutes, the hours, the day of the week, the day of the month, and the year. And this was in 1867. It wasn't even digitized. I mean, digital, you know, it had to work on all these gears. He had moved his factory to a number of buildings around Ann Arbor, but all in all, only produced 30 watches, none of which was sold. He gave them to 30 stockholders in his company because they didn't make any money because no watches were sold. However, one of these watches somehow came into the possession of the Washtenaw County Historical Society, and it resides in a lockbox in a local bank. So watch collectors are still looking in attics, cellars, old boxes for one of these watches. So we know there's 29 out there in the world somewhere. One is here in Ann Arbor. Now this picture does not appear in the book, but because of the present season that we're in, and that's not thinking about yesterday at all, I thought it was appropriate for this season, and it is the first football team at Michigan, 1879, and there they are. There was one forward, three halfbacks, eight rushers, one goalkeeper, and three substitutes. And they played the game in innings. Not quarters, not halves, innings. And it was known as rugby football at that time. Greg Kinney at the Bentley Library is the go-to person for any information about sports at the University of Michigan. He keeps the history, he has beautiful exhibitions online, and can answer almost any question that you might have. Now this gentleman looks pretty innocent. This is Thomas Trueblood, known to his other faculty members as Truby. And you know that on the campus there is a Trueblood Theater. Okay, he was hired by the university to teach elocution an oratory, speaking so people could understand you. Elocution. People, I understand that they used to practice putting pebbles in their mouths so they could speak clearly and speak above that. But one of his students, who was a freshman student here, went to the Chicago Tribune and told them that this professor was teaching lessons in how to love. And consequently, Mr. Trueblood was relieved of his duties for about a year. What he was doing was taking a scene from a play, having a female student play a standing or sitting female, and the male student kneel on one knee and recite the dialogue from this particular play. I'm sure they were sweet words, wonderful words, but it was not a lesson in making love. Also, Truby was a pioneer because when he was hired back by the university, his classes in speech became so important and so popular that the university established the first department of speech probably in the world. But Truby also didn't follow all the rules of the university, rules and regulations. And on his debate team, he chose to put Eugene Marshall, who was an African-American, and that was not within the policy of the university. However, Mr. Marshall became the 1903 champ in the Big Ten. Truby himself became a champion. He was the champion faculty tennis player at the university until a health issue required a comment from his doctor that he should find something else to do with his time. So he took up golf. And then he became the golf coach for the university. And his teams won several Big Ten conferences and were the champions, as they should be. Okay. This is Aunt Ruth. Did anybody know Aunt Ruth? She was a secretary or a receptionist at the university. She had no children. She really didn't have family in the Ann Arbor area. But during World War II, she took it upon herself to write letters to anyone who was serving in the armed forces. That included students, faculty, staff, and alumni. She sent 17,828 letters. She sent 6,952 birthday cards and 7,398 get well cards to those who had been injured in the war. She got return letters by the tens of thousands from these people who were serving, and she was invited to their weddings. Suddenly word got out and across the country, and she was awarded a medal by the federal government for the work that she had done during the war. Yes, Bentley. So here we are with Albert Wheeler. Who knew him? See, I didn't get here soon enough to know all these really great people. I feel bad about that. He and his wife, Emma, had come to Ann Arbor, where Albert was the first tenured African-American professor, and his area was public health. But both of them, husband and wife, were civil rights activists, and they really strengthened their civil rights activities when they were denied by an Ann Arbor bank a mortgage, and they had 30% cash to put down and still were denied a mortgage. So they were both active in the NAACP. They were among the founders of the Ann Arbor Human Rights Council and the Michigan Civil Rights Committee. And he was the first African-American mayor of Ann Arbor. So now we have Wheeler Park named for him or them. And you can sort of take your pick because they were both very active. And that park is on Depot Street between 4th and 5th Avenue. Does this look like an intimidating person? Anybody know him? This is Sam Ross. Sam Ross was from Ann Arbor. He liked to tinker with motors, and he began racing cars in Southeast Michigan on dirt tracks. Well, he got to be so good at it that in 1922, he had a sponsor, and he moved up to the Indianapolis 500. So then he gave up dirt tracks for a brick track at that time. And he did manage to get in the front of the a pack of 35 cars, put in a few laps. Then he hit a bump in the brick track, which hit his head and caused him to black out, which he managed to get to his pit at the racetrack and blacked out two times there. So at that time, you could have a relief driver, and a relief driver named Wilbur Shaw. Wilbur Shaw was one of the founders of the Indianapolis 500. Jumped into his car, revved up the engine to get back out there on the track, and blew the engine. And that was the end. That was the end of that race and the story of Sam Ross. Now this is a nurse in the desert. Looks pretty glamorous, doesn't she? Okay, this is Mildred Radowick. And she was a World War II nurse, and she practiced at UM Hospital. But she was called up to go to war. She had 10 days to get everything in order and ship out. And she postponed her marriage to a doctor at the hospital in order to go serve. So she wrote in her book that it was a harrowing ocean trip to get to North Africa, and then even worse, across the Sahara to get to where the troops were. She says that she went through air raids, buzz bombs, the death of a fellow nurse. She helped the soldiers who were injured at the Battle of the Bulge. And in her book at that, she talks about walking on bodies to get to those who were still living and just injured. And she also was there to help the victims when Buchenwald was freed and those victims there. However, before she shipped out of New York to start this venture with the Army, she found a dress in New York City that just called to her, and she couldn't give it up. Gold lamé. So she bought it, and she packed it with her uniforms, and off she went. Now, the people, this is a surgical unit she was working with during the war, and they saw, as you can tell, just horrible things on the war front, and endured that and tried to keep their spirits up all the time. So one time they had a little break in the action, and they decided they would have some leisure time, and they arranged for a dance somewhere there in the desert. Mildred puts on the gold lamé outfit, climbs into an army truck, and away they went and had a little break from their jobs and the horrific things that they were experiencing. Then this woman had done her duty. She was on her way back to the States, but she went through Paris. And she saw a little French poodle there. And it was kind of like the dress. It sort of called to her. So she smuggled the French poodle into the United States. And the happy part of this story is she married the doctor. And so there was a happy ending to that story. Now, who knows who this is? What's his name?
Bob Ufer.
Who can say the word Michigan the way?
Michigan.
This lady gets a book free.
Woo!
That was good. That was good. Okay, remember that. So his style of announcing was known as partisan hysterics. And he was known as also as the voice. But he did announce 362 straight UM football games. I would hate to hear what he said yesterday. Just, I'm glad he didn't have to see it. But he did say, and is quoted as saying, Michigan football is a religion. Saturday is a day of obligation. There you are. This is Bill Lewis. He is still with us. He is a painter. He was one of the founders of the Pottery Guild in Ann Arbor. And while he was an art student here, he was called up by the Navy in World War II. And he was shipping out of San Diego. And he got out there and he wrote to his mom, send me my paints. And she did. Now, there were rules during wartime. You would take no pictures of installations, no pictures, no photos of ships, and so on and so forth, or any military bases. But they overlooked him because, God forbid, he was an artist and he just had watercolors. What did anybody care? So on his way, on his ship through the Pacific, he captured ships engaged in battle, and this was all in his watercolors. Ships that were in dry dock, that is something you would not want the enemy to know you had, which ships were in dry dock. And also he was among the group that went into bombed out Yokohama, and he has watercolors of those. He came back, he finished his studies, and became a member of the faculty. And bless his heart, when I did a story about his watercolors some years ago while I was still working, he gave me not a watercolor from the Second World War, but a watercolor he had done of some flowers. And I just burst into tears when he came into my office with this rolled up piece of paper. And I still have it. I have it framed. And it's just a lovely memory of a great man. And I saw he and his wife not too long ago at Holiday's restaurant. They were coming in for lunch. He's very hard of hearing now, and I'm sure he's in his 90s. But he was as gracious as I remember him being, having done some work for him. Okay, do we see what the sign says up above? The Sugar Bowl. Four brothers came into Ann Arbor from Greece, and they opened the Sugar Bowl in 1911. Originally, they lived and made candy on the second floor of the building, and they made homemade ice cream in the basement. Well, their business grew, and it grew into sandwiches and to about a decent, almost full-service restaurant after a while. And they needed help. So they sent to Greece for their youngest brother, who came and was still a schoolboy in short pants. And they put him to work making the ice cream in the basement. And this youngster was so embarrassed to go to school, but education was very important to this family. And they made sure he went to school, but he was embarrassed because his hands were so chapped, working with the ice and the salt to make the ice cream. Eventually, they started hiring from the community. So it expanded from just the family and the four brothers into the community. The Sugar Bowl closed in 1967. I missed it again.
Where was it located?
Main Street. And supposedly, there was some talk that it was the first internally lighted sign on Main Street. I can't confirm that, but that's what's been said. Now, do you know who this is? Well, he was a dishwasher at the Sugar Bowl. He earned 25 cents an hour. They called him Jerry, G-E-R-R-Y, but we know him as President Ford. And of course, he played football for UM. But he started out there, dishwasher to president. Not bad. This is Dr. Snowflake. I first saw his work at the Toledo Museum because there was a large display up there of his cutouts. He was a hospital physician at UM. His name is Thomas Clark, Dr. Thomas Clark. He is still cutting. He's been doing cutouts since 1987. And he learned the skill from a nurse who learned it from a patient. Primarily, he does biblical stories. If you get on your computer and just put in Dr. Thomas Clark, you will find a page that has some of his much more intricate cutouts on there that you can see, one of which is his interpretation of Noah's Ark with all the animals. It is just fantastic. In this age of computers, you would think it was done by a computer. No, it's a man cutting paper. He does have an annual workshop, and it will be at the hospital. If you're interested in doing this, you contact Dr. Clark from his information on Explorer, Google, whatever you're using. Here's another place. Who has been to the Fleetwood to eat? You just walk by. Yes, known as the home of hippie hash. But in 1948, Ann Arbor's Donald Reed, R-E-I-D, went to the Dagwood Diner Company in Toledo, Ohio, and bought a kit to put up a diner. It was only 16 by 32, and at that time, the city had an ordinance for no buildings less than 1,000 square feet. But he was really in love with his diner. And the city council must have been in love with Donald Reed and his diner. And they gave a dispensation that he could build his diner, put it together, there at the corner of Ashley and Liberty. And it's still there. Well, its first name was the Dagwood Diner, and it was D-A-G hyphen W-O-O-D to make it separate from the Dagwood comic strip. But over the years that it has changed ownership, it has also changed its name, and it is now the Fleetwood Diner. If you haven't been there, I suggest that you go. It is an experience. Go for a cup of coffee. You don't have to eat the food if you don't want to. Hippie hash may not be your thing, but that's all right. But Judy Stee, you were in California, and you went to a restaurant, and they had hippie hash on the menu. Did they say it originated in Ann Arbor?
No, I confronted the owner, and I said, I'm from Ann Arbor. And he said, well, I'm from Ann Arbor, too, and I stole the recipe from the Fleetwood Diner.
So, what you can be famous for is an interesting fact. Even the fellow in California who stole the recipe for hippie hash. This is the person who's here today. This is Jan Longoni. Stand up, Jan, so we can see you in the live flesh, which will look much better than this from a photo that didn't turn out too well. Jan learned to read early in her life, and she has never stopped. And we have a retired librarian here who can attest to that, because she said she checked books out to Jan all the time here, and she can attest that she was an avid reader. She began with her husband, Dan. Okay, Dan, come on. Okay, he's waving. This is Dan, Dan Longoni. They had a wine and food library that they worked from their home. I had never heard of this before. I was not in Ann Arbor at the time, but I was doing reporting on the National Beef Cook-Off in Cheyenne, Wyoming, for a couple of Indiana newspapers. And all the reporters were on a bus being taken to a ranch. And in the background, I could hear Bert Wolf. Do you remember Bert Wolf from television? Talking about this place in Ann Arbor, where if there's anything you needed to know, it was this wine and food library. No. Sure. And he just raved and raved about it, but it stuck in my mind. I will tell you also that on that trip to Cheyenne, and we went on a bus out to this ranch, and we rode on this bus from a highway on a ranch road, be a driveway, for miles and miles and miles. And we got to the ranch house. A small, probably single story or story and a half, little white house set out, and it had some grass around it. And in the front yard was a backhoe that had been digging, and there was a big pile of dirt out there. And being a sort of a country girl, I said to myself, oh my God, they have all these people here and their septic tank is not working and they're having to dig it up. What are they going to do? And then I realized that in that pit was a steer that had been cooking for a number of days, and they had just uncovered the top layer of earth with the backhoe, and people with shovels then got down into the pit to take the rest of the beef out of there. But I'm so glad they weren't having septic tank problems. So Jan herself, while she has been a judge for many cookbooks for various competitions, has herself been awarded a Silver Spoon Award. She was the book person of the year at one of Ann Arbor's book fests. And she also was given the Amelia Award by the New York Culinary Historians. When I worked for the university and I chose to do the arts and the humanities, and I went to Clements Library, and this woman was there, and actually, I didn't recognize her at first, but I did recognize her name as Jan Longoni from Cheyenne, Wyoming. And she was working on cookbooks as a collection. And people think of cookbooks, you just look in there for a recipe, but it's not true. You can find out about transportation or lack of. You can find out about graphics and printing from cookbooks and how old they are and when they came about. You can find out when freezing took the place of icing. You can find out what type of products were being produced in any section of the country or the world that were being used. So a cookbook can tell you, give you a social history, an economic history, maybe an agrarian history. It's all there. And then at the end, you can make whatever it says to make and have a really good time and just eat the food, which is a pleasure. So she began to talk about her club, a food club, a culinary club. And so for about 5 years, I kept thinking, God, I wish she'd invite me to be a member of her club. Because I think, oh, this is a close thing, and I really am interested in food, and I want to be a member of this club. So after about, she never invited me. So after about 5 years, I figured in, you just invite yourself. You just fill out a membership form, and you go to the meetings. So I've been going to the meetings for a number of years, and I have enjoyed it. But Jan and Dan are the founders of the Culinary Historians of Ann Arbor. And I urge you to, if you're interested in food, to get online, look at the website, and find the membership form on there for the monthly meetings. And the monthly meetings, the Culinary Historians are in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library, and we are currently meeting at once a month at Mallets Creek Library. So you can look at the library calendar also and figure out what's going on.
Who are the directors? Who are the presidents of culinary?
I have no idea. There is no president. There are two co-chairmen. Okay, myself and Judy Steele. Oh, Judy just resigned. And so we will have a new one, because I'm not doing this all by myself. That's how that goes. So here, old 98, Tom Harmon, right. He played, he was a halfback. Well, he started playing football at UM in 1938. But in 1939 and 1940, he was a halfback. Now, I have to tell you, I watch football. I have no idea what a halfback is. They all look like whole people to me. I don't know. I don't have a clue. Oh, and then they talk about a nickelback. Is that half a dime? If that's so, then what's a dime back? I have no clue. Hockey, I can understand. Okay. So, during those years, he became UM's first Heisman Trophy winner. But he was called to go into the services, and he became a World War II pilot. But in those three seasons that he played football, this will be meaningful to some of you, he rushed. Remember, we had so many, 8 rushers on the first team. I think that means run fast. I'm not sure. But okay. But he rushed for 2,134 yards. He had 33 touchdowns and the same number of points after touchdown, known as Pat. First one I watched last night, the guy missed. I'm thinking to me, come on. So he had 2 field goals and for 237 career points. And he had 16 touchdown passes. Okay. So when he became a pilot, he numbered his plane. He had his plane labeled as number 98, because that was his number here at Michigan. He went to Hollywood. He didn't go on to the pros. He left Michigan. And he married a film star. Why not? That's where you go. And he became a sports broadcaster and a director. This couple of movie star and football player had children. One of them was a son. He played quarterback for UCLA. His name is Mark, and he stars in, since 2003, he's been starring in the TV series NCIS. That is Mark Harmon. That is old 98's kid. So does that make it, let's see, half of that would be, what's half of 98? Somebody that does math? So that would be Mark Harmon would be old 47? I mean, he has gray hair now. Okay.
But tell us the name of this beauty queen wife.
I will have to look it up for you. It is not one. It was not Ava Gabor. Ava Gardner. It was not Ava Gardner.
She's
it was
very famous here in Ann Arbor, let me tell
you. The woman was?
Yeah.
The star?
Because she's
tell us more.
Because she's Sam
Town. Oh. Well, we'll have to. I didn't bring a book up here with me. If you have a book. Oh, Tom's not. That's not in the book. I'm sorry. I cheated you. Okay. That's part of the transparency program. I cheated you. I'm sorry. Okay. Now, anybody ever had contact with this gentleman? His name was George Johnson. He was the doorman at the Michigan Union. And since the union opened in 1904, women were not permitted into the union. And later, women could come in, but they had to use the side door. That would be the north door. But they could not use all the rooms in the union. There was a ladies' dining room and so on. However, if there were being a ball, a dance in the union, a woman could enter with her escort through the front door. But a woman alone would hear from George Johnson, "Please use the side doors, ma'am." The story goes that even when JFK came to Ann Arbor and UM to give his, what has now become his famous speech on the steps of the Union for the Peace Corps, that even at that time, he was not president, he was running for Senate. Was he running for president then? I can't remember, running for president. And that his wife was not permitted to go in the front door. She had to use the side door. A political boo-boo, was it? Now this fellow was an interesting character. Irving Pond. He and his brother grew up in a house on property where some of the Michigan Union now stands. So it would have been where the Michigan Union is on State Street, back behind, not next door where the judge's house was, where the property they took, but back behind was the Pond family home. Also, at that time, there was a fence, a wooden fence, that ran along State Street. Some people said it was to keep the students in on the university property. Other people said it was to keep the town people from going in. One never knows, but it was there. And it had a railing that went across the top. And as a kid, Irving Pond, who probably could be called an amateur acrobat, used to do flips along that board on top of the fence. Okay. He did enter the UM and he graduated with an engineering degree. But he became most generally known for as an architect. And the libraries and unions that he designed are at Purdue, University of Michigan, Michigan State, I think there's one in Wisconsin. I went to the Purdue Union to meet a friend and we were staying overnight in the union. And I walked in and I thought, deja vu. I know I've never been here before, but everything looked just like the Michigan Union. There it was, you could just tell. So he, Irving Pond, was on the first football team that we saw earlier for UM in 1879. And it was the only time that he played football for UM. And UM was going to play Racine College. White Stocking Park in Chicago. Okay. Somehow or other, during this game, Pond got the ball. So he began rushing, of course, that was the term. He was running down the sidelines, and there were, at that time, there were not really strict rules of what was what. I mean, they were playing innings, for goodness sakes. So anyway, he's running down the sideline with the ball, and he hears someone from the opposite team coming up behind him. So Irving jumps up onto the bleachers and runs down the bleachers, knows that there's more of the enemy there at the goal line, so he does a somersault over all of them, has the ball, end of the game, Michigan 1, Racine 0. This was on his 80th birthday in Chicago, on a rooftop in Chicago, when he just wanted to demonstrate his fitness. I think he did a forward flip with the football, actually. I don't think he did. Now, this is Lewis the Cat. Lewis the Cat actually adopted the Home and Garden hardware store on Ashley. And was there for about 13 or 15 years. Was very companionable to customers and staff alone. Let children pet Lewis. So he was just friendly to everyone. And liked to keep tabs on what was going on in town by lying in the front window, looking out on Ashley Street, just making sure that everything was proper. Lewis died in 2014. But I think he's been reincarnated because there's another orange cat there that hangs out at home. What is
Wallace?
Wallace is his name. Okay. Wallace now has taken Lewis's place. But Wallace is living a dangerous life because I see Wallace crossing through traffic across Liberty to get to the Fleetwood, where there must be wondrous things. And I've seen traffic stop for Wallace. I'm glad you told me his name.
He has an electronic collar.
Okay. Well, Beth Johnson wrote this book about Lewis and did the artwork, and she gave us permission to use this off the cover of the book. The book is out of print. I suppose if you wanted to call Beth Johnson and see if there are any more, but I think I bought the last one over a year ago from Home and Garden. Okay, like this picture? See any similarities? Okay. This is Mark Tucker. He teaches art at the University of Michigan for non-art majors. Anybody who thinks they want to play with art, is that correct? Can probably get into one of Mark's classes. He's been an artist in European countries, Boston, Detroit, Ann Arbor. And in Detroit at one time was the art director for the Detroit Holiday Parade. Okay. He designed and constructed sets for movies, TV commercials, and theater. And I know that he had been working with the Burns Park Players. I don't know whether he's still doing that or not. But he's known for throwing parades. And this is part of what was in one of the first Fool's Parades in Ann Arbor, which is always held on the Sunday before April Fool's Day. Anyone can enter the parade, cannot be motorized. You can walk, you can ride a bicycle. The library usually runs something on that day where children come. I've seen them turn themselves into robots in cardboard boxes with their arms sticking out and so on, and they walk with their parents in the parade. Or you can help make these giant puppets to take through the parade. If you want to volunteer to work on puppets or at the parade, I was at the parade. My job was crowd control. Can you imagine me, old lady, saying, please keep your children back on the curb. Get them back on the curb, you know. Don't let them out in the middle of the parade. But, and therefore, I got this wonderful shirt for my duty there. So now, Wonderful Productions is what you want to look for if you want to volunteer. So besides the parade in April, for April Fool's Day, they also have the night before the Full Moon Parade, where you make lighted lanterns. And there are workshops in town where you can, they will help you get yours made if you want to start from scratch. Or usually you can buy a kit from them and make it. And it's illuminated with what would be a small candle, votive light candle that runs on a battery. Okay, and now they are producing Ipsy Glow. And that is at night in Ypsilanti, where everything glows, not with just electrical light, but with black light also. So you have iridescent paints and so on in store windows, on the streets, on the sidewalks. Mark's thoughts about this type of art, public art, he says it's dynamic, it's educational, it's collaborative, it's entertaining, and a public art experience. And it's a great thing to volunteer for. I don't advise you to be traffic and kid control. I do advise that you go help them make these paper, beautiful paper mache puppets, which he is an Italian tradition in their parades, often to mock politicians. So I remember, I'm not sure, but in one of the ones I worked at, there was a cat, a furry cat that required two people to be in it. And so like you would have a horse with two people, so this furry cat. And the cat comes down in the parade, and out the back end of the cat comes a big furry pillow ploppo in the street. And the little children go, oh, they just scream and scream. And then the cat goes a little further down the street, and out of its mouth comes a big hairy fur ball. And the kids just scream, yes, yes, yes. But the great thing about this parade is you get to see it twice. It goes north on Main Street, turns around, comes back south on Main Street. If you miss something the first time through, you get a second chance at this. It's not every parade that you get two chances. Okay, this is our last, my last slide. And it should be, because it's David Zinn with a Z. So it is last. He is a chalk artist. He's an Ann Arbor native. When I first came to town, I knew nothing about him, but I had trouble getting radio transmissions when I was at Geddes Lake. I don't know why, but it was difficult to get WUOM there. But from my car, I got terrific reception. And on Sunday evenings, there was something called the Mud Pie Cafe. And David Zinn was running it and producing it. And it was music for children. And he read poems and little stories for children. So I'm driving around Ann Arbor, just having a great time for an hour, listening to the Mud Pie Cafe, laughing and singing along to some of the songs that I knew. But that, when the station went to just all talk, that was scrapped. He also was had at one time something called the Rugrat Review. But currently, as an artist and a self-taught artist, he does chalk drawings on sidewalks, which you swear are three-dimensional. But of course, they are not. And he does them on subway platforms, not in this city, but he does them on subway platforms. He does book illustrations, t-shirts. He does coasters, restaurant placemats, cake icing, and even snow. Now, I have not figured out how you do snow, but I need to learn that. He does have a degree from UM in creative writing and the English language. But he just had to, you know, he had this art feeling that needed to be expressed. He also has designed costumes for some New York productions. In Indiana, there is the city of Columbus, which is the county seat for Bartholomew County. It had a lot of money because Cummins Engine Company was the only company in town. If you know Cummins Engines, they drive the diesels on the trains that come back and forth, big heavy equipment and so on. So there was a lot of money there. And the man who started Cummins Engine Company wanted his town to be different. So he would pay the fee for an architect to design the firehouse, a school, a church. Somebody else, the community came up with the money to pay for the actual buildings or even the jail there is by a famous designer. So there's I.M. Pei, some of the others have done work there. And the city calls itself the Athens on the Prairie. So a friend of mine sent me a newspaper article just a couple weeks ago, and it has a picture of David Zinn drawing on the sidewalk. Well, Columbus, Indiana has decided that senior citizens should walk more. And they're promoting their sidewalks in Columbus. And they hired David to come and decorate their sidewalks. And I thought, what a cool idea. And if we're talking public art, entertainment, exercise, good health, and a city all bound together to do these things. So I'm sorry to say that because his name starts with Z, this is the last one. But I do thank you for coming and hope you enjoyed it and that you will enjoy the stories that are in the book.